Thank you, Brother Darrell. I call your attention to 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel is where we were last Sunday night, and we'll finish up the chapter this evening. Last week, we looked at the first part of this where that we were introduced to a man named Kish. We're also introduced to a man named Saul. There was a man that is unnamed who was a servant of Saul. There were some young maidens that we didn't know their name. We found some things that just kind of happened by accident. Wink, wink. And when we saw these things, we realized that God had put a plan into place that was happening. We had some donkeys that just happened to walk off. Then, men that had been experienced in finding lost livestock couldn't pick up the trail. They looked for 3 days and they couldn't find anything. They went all over the place. They went all through the mountains of Ephraim. Finally, they came to a little place and there was some girls there. And the girls were there at just the right time. They had just the right information that Saul and his servant needed. And so when we see that as our backdrop, and then in verses 15 through 17, we have God whispering in the ear of Samuel. It brings us up to speed beginning in verse 18 tonight. In verse 18, it says, "Then Samuel drew near to Samuel in the gate." When you read about the gate in the Old Testament, or the New Testament for that matter, that is a place of commerce. That's a place where a lot of business was done. It was often where the leaders of the city would congregate. Sometime we joke about men that will go to certain establishments every morning and how that they're solving all the world's problems. Well, these men would sit at the gates of their city and they would discuss things. It was where sometimes judicial matters would be handled. And so they drew near to the gate. And they said, "Tell me, I pray thee, where the seer's house is." Well, it just so happened that God had arranged this meeting. And in verse 19, it says that Samuel answered Saul. And he said, "I'm the seer." Now, there's a difference between a prophet and a seer. And I don't remember if I told you this last week or not, but basically a seer is a person that believed, or not believed, but a person that was tasked with visions. They would see visions of things that were going to happen. An example of that would be way back over in the book of Genesis was Joseph, when God would give him the ability to reveal a dream. He would have a vision of what people would see, and he would be able to give them an answer. Well, Samuel calls himself a seer. But he is also known as a prophet. You also know that he was known as a judge. He was known as a leader. And Samuel, for 60 years, has been living for God. And I guess I shouldn't maybe say 60 years, but from the time that he was conceived, God was going to bless that young man and now that old man. And when he got old enough to be weaned from his mother, he went to serve in the tabernacle at a place called Shiloh. We have churches that are named Shiloh from time to time. And it all goes back to that early place where Samuel served under Eli the high priest. Well, when you look at verse 19, and he says, "I'm the seer." And then he says, "I want you to go up before me unto the high place." Now, usually when you read in the Old Testament about the high place, it's not a good place. It's a place where a lot of pagan activity has taken place. As a matter of fact, high place, or a phrase similar to that, is used 117 times in the Old Testament. And almost on every occasion that that's used, it's speaking of something that is bad. The Canaanites were a group of people, and they had other groups that would kind of absorb their gods from time to time. But the Canaanites had 26 major gods that they would worship. And these people would go up into the high places, and they would worship in what was called the groves. They would have trees, and they would have huge ceremonies. They would have sacrifices to all of these pagan idols. And it was a high place. In Israel today, if you went to David's palace, what they consider to be the ruins of David's palace, one of the things that a guide will tell you is this: this is the second most highest point in the old city of Jerusalem. And then he'll say, the highest point is where the Temple Mount is, and that's what David gave to God because he wanted God to have the highest place. Well, that makes sense, because David was a man after God's own heart. And so when we look at this portion of Scripture, and it says that he wanted him to go to the high place outside of the city of Ramah, is where they would, I guess, offer the sacrifice. Perhaps there was a place that was on a hill, and it was the highest one around, and this place had been dedicated not to a pagan god, but it had been dedicated to Jehovah. And so that's what we see Samuel doing, and evidently they have built a structure there. And the reason that I tell you that is because there's going to be some people that will eat with them. And so you'll see that in a moment. And he says, you shall eat with me today, and tomorrow I'll let you go. In other words, you don't really have much choice about this, because I've got some things that you need to know. And I will tell thee all that is in thine heart. Now, I don't know about you, but if a guy is about to tell me everything that's in my heart, I'm interested. And that's exactly what we have in our passage. We've got a man that's got the capability of doing that. He's been able to do that now for his entire ministry. He's been able to do it from the time that he was probably a teenager. He was able to discern and look into the hearts of people. I don't know if Saul was scared about that. Be honest with you, I think that most of us at some time in our lives, if somebody said, I'm going to really look into your heart, and if they had that ability, it would probably scare us to death. Because the Bible says that the heart is deceitful and desperately wicked. Who can know it? And so he says, I'm going to tell you all that's in thine heart. Verse 20. And this is something that I'm sure got his attention, because nobody has mentioned this. It's not in the story. And then all of a sudden in verse 20 he says, and as for thine asses that were lost 3 days ago, set not thy mind on them, for they are found. Now imagine that. This man has been looking for days for his dad's livestock. He's gone high and low all through that land. And then he meets the man of God, and the man says, oh, by the way, you know those donkeys that you were looking for? They're okay. And I'm sure he's thinking, this is different than any man I've ever met before. Well, the truth of the matter is, Samuel was different than any man he had ever met before. I can't get over the fact that 5 miles from where Samuel lived is where Saul lived. And he didn't know about the man of God. His servant did, but Saul didn't. That absolutely astounds me. a man that was 60 years old that had lived in that town, had been a circuit riding preacher, so to speak. No doubt the stories had been all over Gibeah. But Saul just didn't care about spiritual things. And so he says, those donkeys that you're looking for, they're okay. But then what he does is he says, let me ask you a question. And on whom is all the desire of Israel? You say, well, what desire was that? Do you not remember that they said, we want a king? And so no doubt Saul knew that people wanted a king. They made no bones about it. And before he can answer, he says, is it not on thee and on all thy father's house? In other words, don't you understand that it's you that they're looking for? And the reason is because he was head and shoulders above everybody else. He was the biggest. Now, I don't know if this has held true the entire time that we have been electing presidents in this country. But at one point, the overwhelming majority of people that have been elected to be president of the United States were the taller of the candidates. Evidently, there's something about looking for somebody that's tall, dark, and handsome. And I guess whenever a guy's doing a press conference, they want somebody that looks a little better than somebody else. But when you look at this man, I believe in verse 21, there's some humility that's maybe not quite genuine. Let's look at it. And Saul answered and said, am not I a Benjaminite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel? Well, you know what? That was true. Way back over in Joshua, they had had battles, and Benjamin had lost quite a few people. And there were some people that thought that if it kept going in that direction, that the Benjaminites would go extinct. And so they were the smallest of all the tribes in Israel. But then he goes on to say, and my family, the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin. Now, I want you to look back with me at the first part of this chapter. Flip back over to verse 1. And I want us to look, and I want to see if we really believe this. There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeor, the son of Bechurith, the son of Aphiah, a Benjaminite, a mighty man of power. He had a son whose name was Saul, a choice young man and goodly. And among the children of Israel, a goodlier person than he, they couldn't find one. Said he was higher than the people. But then look at verse 3. The asses of Kish. It didn't say he had one donkey, it said he had multiple donkeys. And what happened? They were lost. Wealthy people are the only ones that had more than one tractor. And the donkey was the tractor. A long time before John Deere and Kubota, you got the donkeys and the oxen that are the tractors. And so his tractors are missing, which means there's not much plowing going on. Well, and so he's got multiple tractors. But then what does it say? Take now one of the servants with thee. So there's multiple servants. You got many people that are working on the ranch. And so when we look back at verse 21, and he says, my family's the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin. I'm going to tell you something, I don't believe it. There are some people that don't even have a tractor. There's some people that might have to use a walk behind Troy belt. There's some people that might have to do it by hand. And I've seen pictures of a long time ago where a wife would be holding the plow and her husband would be pulling it. And so I don't necessarily buy in the fact that he says that my family is the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin. Wherefore then speakest thou so to me? And so when we begin to look at that, he may be feigning a little bit of humility there. Now, one thing that maybe would be in his favor is this. Perhaps when the Lord was saying, okay, we'll let them have a king, he said, we'll choose it, that king, from the smallest of the tribes, so there won't be any jealousy that takes place. I mean, after all, you could take some of the larger tribes, like the tribe of Judah, the tribe of Reuben, some of those larger tribes. And then all of a sudden somebody would say, well, I think our guy should have got it. But if you go from Benjamin, who is the smallest, perhaps there's not so much bickering that's going on. And so maybe that's why the Lord said, okay, I'm going to let a man from Benjamin be the first king. Look with me at verse 22. And Samuel took Saul and his servant, and he brought them into the parlor. Isn't that a neat name? The parlor. You know what that's? That just kind of smacks of a southern antebellum place. All right? The parlor. I guarantee you, some of you older ladies, think back to another dispensation when you were courting. And maybe one of those young men that was a suitor, he came over to your house, and your mama said, y'all can go in there in the parlor, leave the door open. Anybody ever had anybody say something like that? Sure you have. And to me, whenever I read the word parlor, I just like the word. It's a beautiful word. And basically, whenever you look at the parlor, what it means is a place where they got guests together. That's what it was. Now, I don't know if it was like the dating parlor at Bob Jones University. And I have no idea what the dating parlor at Bob Jones University looks like today. But I can tell you exactly what it looked like in 1974-75. Basically, it looked like a furniture store. There were couches everywhere. I mean, you had red couches and blue couches, and you had pretty couches and ugly couches, but you had couches that were everywhere. And when you went to the dating parlor, they had monitors that would walk around with rulers and say, you're too close, got to be 12 inches apart. And you go, that's crazy. Well, that was true. And I guarantee you, there's probably still some schools today that have that same thing. We had something similar to that at the school that I attended, Baptist University of America. When Deb and I would sit in chapel, her name was Fontaine, my name was Foskey, and there was a girl named Fortner that sat between us. Cindy Fortner ended up marrying a missionary to Japan, a guy named Mike Burkett. Or Burgett. And he was one of my first roommates. And so when Cindy Fortner wasn't there, there was space there between Foskey and Fontaine. And then we'd slide close together. And you know what Miss Lewis did? She'd give Debbie demerits. Now, she never gave me any because she liked me. But if you ask my wife, and she's great friends with Velva Lewis to this day, she'd say, I don't even know why you give me demerits. You didn't give Tommy any. She'd say, I wasn't in charge of the boys. I was only in charge of the girls. Well, you got this parlor. And it was just basically a place where that you would have guests. But it was a big place. If you look at the latter part of verse 22, after they sat down at the chief place at the table, there were about 30 people there. That's a pretty big room, about 30 people. So imagine about half the size of the dining hall that we've got downstairs. We can put about 75 comfortably in there, maybe 80. It starts getting crowded after 80. But just think about half of the dining hall downstairs, and that's how big this place was that they had built just for banquets. And it's up on a high place. Why? Because that's where they made sacrifice to the Lord. Verse 23. And Samuel said unto the cook, bring the portion which I gave thee, of which I said unto thee, set it by thee. And the cook took up the shoulder, that which was upon it, and set it before Saul. And Samuel said, behold, that which is left, or that which has been set aside from the sacrifice, set it before thee and eat. For until this time hath it been kept for thee, since I said, I've invited the people. So Saul did eat with Samuel that day. And so what you've got is you've got a special piece of meat. Now you say, what kind was it? Well, I don't know if it was goat. I don't know if it was a lamb. I don't know if it was a cow. It wasn't a hog. But I know that they probably took the right shoulder because that was the part that belonged to the priest. Do you remember the story I talked about back when we talked about Eli's boys, Hophni and Phinehas? Way back over 4 or 5 chapters ago. Hophni and Phinehas would have a sacrifice that would be set aside for one of the high days or holy days. They would have a certain portion that would be set aside, and what was left, a man and his family would go back to their little tent, and they would have an open fire, and they would have a pot, and they would cook the remainder of the sacrifice that was left after they gave the right shoulder to the priest. But Hophni and Phinehas would come by after having that good part with their flesh hook, and they would reach in the pot, and they would pull it out, and they'd say, we're taking this with us. And take the man's food, and he wasn't able to enjoy a meal with his family. Why? Because of the ministerial mafia. And so you've got Samuel, and he's got this choice piece of shoulder, and he wants to give this place of honor to Saul. Now, at the end of the message, I'm gonna make this connection here. I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. But this is a pretty big deal for me, because he's doing something that's against nature. And I'll share that with you in just a few minutes. And he says, you eat it. And so they did eat with Samuel that day. Now, it doesn't say how long the meal was, but my guess is they didn't eat in 10 minutes. It was probably at least a couple of hours. And in verse 25, it says, and when they were come down from the high place, they were coming into the city of Ramah, Samuel communed with Saul up on the top of the house. Now remember, in biblical times, what you would have is you would have people that would have flat roofs on their house. And at night, when the sun finally went down, the breeze would begin to blow, and they would walk up the stairs on the outside of the house, and they would sit on the roof. Now, there were probably some type of at least knee or waist-high banisters that were up there. But that's where they would spend a lot of time in the evenings, because it was cool. And so what you have is you've got these men that go up to the top of the roof. And what does it say? It says that they communed. That basically means they got to know one another. And I'm sure that Samuel began to talk about the things that God had done. I'm sure that Saul probably listened intently. And so they talked probably into the wee hours of the morning. And verse 26 tells us, and they arose early, and it came to pass about the spring of the day. When you see that word spring of the day, basically that means it was dawn. It was the early part of the day, right? And Samuel called Saul to the top of the house, saying, "Up, that I may send thee away." And both of them, he and Samuel, abroad. So they went out of the house, and what were they doing? They were walking side by side, shoulder by shoulder. Now, what is significant about that? And I wouldn't think anything about it except that the Bible uses the word abroad. And I don't think that God puts words in the Bible by accident. Every word of God is pure. And so when it says that they came out of the house and they were abroad, that means they were shoulder to shoulder. What would that mean to me? When I think about that, I think, well, what that means is that Saul was being shown that he was worthy to walk next to the man of God. It shows me that Samuel was willing to let him come and him give him a place of prominence. Now, I don't want to tell you this to toot my own horn tonight because it's no big deal about this, but it's something that I've just always done for Brother Don. And some of you have probably done the exact same thing. But when Brother Don and I would travel together, we did this yesterday. We stopped to eat a meal. And I, of course, walked faster than he does. I walked ahead. And instead of just opening the door, bursting through the door, I opened the door and I just hold it. It may take him a minute to get there, but he's going in first. You know why? Because I want to honor my elder. I want to honor the man of God. But here, what you have is, you have a man of God. He's 60 years old. Saul probably at this point is probably about 20 years old. And he says, "You come up here with me." And they walk out together and people see it. And so Samuel is basically handing him a position. And so they came out together. And in verse 27 it says, "And as they were going down to the end of the city." In other words, they had walked down from his house and they had gone back probably to the gate of the city, the end of the road before you got out of town. And by the way, when it uses the word city, a city and a town are two different things biblically. A city has a wall around it. A town usually does not. Towns and villages, they're pretty much defenseless. But a city usually has a fence around it or a wall around it. And so they go to the end of the city. They're about to walk out of the gate. And Samuel says to Saul, "Bid the servant to pass on before us." And Saul said, "Go ahead, I'll be there in a minute." And he passed on. "But stand thou still a while, that I may show thee the word of God." You say, what does he show him? Well, we're going to see what he shows him next week when we get into chapter 10. But I want to give you two closing thoughts tonight. The first thing that I want you to understand is I want you to see in our story the kindness, the generosity, the nobleness, the graciousness of Samuel. Here, this great man of God comes face to face with the man that's going to take his place. Now think about that. Sometimes it's hard for we older men to think about those younger men that's going to take our place. That's a hard thing. You know, I understand there's going to come a time when some younger guy will take my place at this church, just like I've stepped in to take Brother Don's place for a few years. that be the Lord's will. But there's going to be a young guy, God may already have him somewhere, and he'll take my place. And when I look at Samuel, I want to have that type of graciousness when another man steps in. I want to have that type of nobility when my time comes. I want to have that genuineness about my walk with God that he did. From one end to the other, from the time he was a young man, he was established as a prophet. He was established as a seer. In other words, he had visions of God that nobody else could get. He was the man. He was the judge. I mean, when the big cases came forward, they went to Samuel. He was the Supreme Court of his day. But now, he's no longer a judge. Once this king gets anointed, the king now makes those judgments. He doesn't make them. Now, his life is not going to be over, and we're going to get to that in just a moment. But what I want you to see is I want you to see how big this man is. I want you to see the character that this man has. You know, in ancient Rome, when people were involved in politics, one of the things that they would do is they would go out in white robes to try to drum up votes. And what they were conveying, and hence the word a candidate, in ancient Rome, it meant, my character is spotless. Vote for me. That is Samuel. You don't read the life of Samuel and find anything. Now, he had some boys that didn't do right, but they never acted to the extent that Eli's kids did. But you don't find anything in his character that's a problem. And yet, here he is. He's kind. He's gracious. He's gentle. Alexander White said, the noblest thing in some respects in all of Samuel's noble life was the way he took the providence of God in the establishment of the monarchy. In other words, he accepted the fact that he was no longer going to be the judge. He was no longer going to be the leader. And one of the things that you and I always must understand that we can't do it forever. And so I want you to notice, first of all, his nobility. But second of all, I want you to notice this, that sometimes God changes the direction of his servants. Well, he could no longer be a judge, but this doesn't mean that Samuel's life is over. Not by a long shot. He's only 60. You say, well, he don't have the job anymore. Oh, sure he does. Sure he does. You know what you're going to find? You're going to find next week he anoints Saul. But then, in a few chapters, we're going to find that he rebukes Saul because he was disobedient. And ultimately, God took the kingdom from him. And then you will find him anointing King David, the greatest of all the kings. We'll find that. But one thing that we don't really think a lot about when it comes to Samuel is this. We don't always think about something that he probably did until the day he died. He was in charge of a Bible college. You see, there's a phrase that you'll find in your Old Testament, and it'll talk about the company of the prophets. The word company is the idea of a school. And he established little satellite places for prophets and for priests and for psalmists and for singers and for musicians. to come and receive training. And just as he had preached in those circuits and had judged all of Israel, now he was going from place to place to place to place, and he would train those young men for the ministry. And when you look at him, you see the results of his work. Because you see, David and Gad and Nathan and Elijah and Elisha, several of the minor prophets, all of them were helped by those school of the prophets. Where do you think those musicians that helped David, where do you think they were trained? Many of them were trained at the school of the prophets. Where do you think David got much of his inspiration? And you say, well, he got it from the Lord. Sure he did. But I believe that God used other people to bless him. And many of them were the prophets from the school. But none of that would have happened had it not been for the man of God, Samuel. And so, don't think that just because somebody takes your place, don't think that because you've been doing something, like judging Israel or pastoring, don't think that when that's over, that God's done with you, because that's not true. What we've got to do is we've got to realize that sometimes God changes directions. And that's all he did with Samuel. And he lived many, many more years. And God blessed him. And so that's the message for tonight. That's the message for this evening. Let's stand together.